Kia ora tātou, one and all. Welcome. I'm Joe Hollander, Chair of the Engineer Charitable Trust and the Palmerston North Defence Heritage Advisory Group. And again, it's my pleasure to welcome you all here tonight. This is our first of our evening public lecture presentations, or four presentations this year. Tonight we were supposed to have had a meeting by Wuru Tiawiawi. Unfortunately, his electric car has run out of juice, but I'll let the mayor tell you a little bit more about that. So look, without further ado, I'm going to call on Mayor Grant to say a few words before I introduce our speaker this evening. Your Worship.
Kia ora everyone, and look, thank you Joe. Yeah, apologies from Whittemoo. He did ring me looking for an extension cord, but I said I didn't have one long enough. But no, seriously, he's taken two electric cars, but of course we've got to plug them in. Anyway, welcome everybody, and lovely to see quite a good crowd actually for our first public military heritage lecture series. This is for 2023. This is the first of four, and just want to acknowledge our presenter, Dr. Glyn Harper, and obviously the Gallipoli campaign, which we'll be eagerly waiting to hear your version. I just want to acknowledge a few people here tonight. Obviously, the City Library, thank you for hosting, along with the Engineers Charitable Trust. Of course, very poignant because tomorrow we acknowledge Anzac Day. And, I'm really hoping the weather gods are with us tomorrow and we will have good crowds that will attend the Dawn, the Civic, and many of the other services around the region. But anyway, great to have you all here. Look forward to hearing from your group. And thank you, Joe, for all the organisation in the background. Have a great evening. Thank you.
Thanks, Grant. Also acknowledge the City Library Heritage Team who really put everything on tonight, and also thank the Mayor for putting on some refreshments, which you're all welcome to partake of at the conclusion of this presentation. Our speaker tonight is probably very well known to pretty much all of you. Glyn has spent a lot of time doing research and writing a whole range of military history books, presentations and the like, and he's a regular speaker on our particular military history tours, if you like. So really, without further ado, I would welcome Glyn to the podium and to talk about an alternative view on the Gallipoli campaign. Glyn.
Thank you, Joe, thank you, Grant, and thank you to the Library for making this possible. I will point out that the last time I gave a presentation here, Joe Hollander had a shot at me for not wearing a tie, so I decided I'd wear one tonight. It actually was a gift from the Australian War Memorial, so I thought it was very, very appropriate, particularly with some of the positive moves that are happening in Australia at the moment. This is the outline of my talk. I'm going to be talking about giving a short introduction. I'm going to talk about the muddle, which is really the sequence of events which happens from the 25th of April onwards. I'm going to then look at some of the myths around Gallipoli, but I'm only going to touch on three. There are many that I could potentially touch on, but I think three is enough for an evening like this. I'll look at meanings and then have some type of conclusion. Now, the reality is that for both Australia and New Zealand, the Gallipoli campaign holds a particular fascination. This is especially true in Australia, where Gallipoli has been described by this historian as surely the most overworked subject in Australian military history, the words of Robin Pryor. In fact, Robin went so far as to suggest at a conference that I attended at the Australian War Memorial that historians should be awarded grants for not writing books about Gallipoli, but for writing them too. However, since he made that comment, he wrote a book about Gallipoli. And there it is there. And I don't know if he got a grant, so I'll leave that for him. But as the first clash of arms in a total war for both Australia and New Zealand, The Gallipoli campaign has assumed a cultural significance out of all proportion to the military realities of the time. The significance has seen Gallipoli overshadow other military engagements of equal or even greater importance to both Australia and New Zealand. And I need to say too that it is most unusual for nations to associate one of their most defining moments with a severe military defeat or a campaign that was marked from its very inception with nothing but poor planning, muddle and confusion. And some very powerful and persistent myths have been woven into that Gallipoli experience, and some of these I will address today. Before I do though, I recently reread Les Carlyon's book on Gallipoli, and he has this warning, and I think it needs to be kept in mind. And he was talking about the thousands of New Zealanders and Australians who feel the need to visit Gallipoli as a rite of passage. And he made this comment, and I think it's very apt. Gallipoli, as a wise man once said, is a country of the mind. Everyone who comes here, that's Gallipoli, sees the story the way they want to see it. And he also says they're actually looking for a past that doesn't exist anymore. So let's move on and now talk about the muddle. Now, the fact that it was even necessary to clear the shores of the Dardanelles highlighted the poor planning and execution that dogs this campaign from its inception. Initially, it was meant to be a purely naval affair, but two attempts to force open the Narrows, first on the 19th of February and then on the 18th of March, were complete failures. The one on the 18th of March was an absolute disaster, and it's because of this minefield here. There are the dense minefields across the Narrows. There are the shore batteries on either side which need to be dealt with. But after the 19th of February, a very astute naval officer in the Turkish Navy noticed that the ships were coming up and turning around in this bay. So he laid a set of mines parallel to the coast where the ships were turning, and guess what? He scored three capital ships who turned along here, including the Ocean, the Irresistible, and the Bouvet, the ships in a single day. Three were sunk, three were badly damaged, and they accepted the fact that they could not get through that narrow passage without one of the shores being cleared. But I have to say, when we look at the Gallipoli campaign, we commemorate the 25th of April. For the Turkish nation, it's the 18th of March, which is their national day around Gallipoli, and that is the reason why. So it becomes evident that there's going to need to be a ground force assembled so that they can clear that Gallipoli Peninsula. And there is the Mediterranean Expeditionary Force formed under General Sir Ian Hamilton, and it's given this formidable task. The Mediterranean Expeditionary Force consists of five divisions. The 29th, the Royal Naval Division, one of the brainchilds of Winston Churchill and not at full strength. The 1st Australian Division, the New Zealand and Australian Division, which are two infantry brigades and two light horse or mounted rifle brigades. And then there is the Corps Expeditionary of the Orient, which are French territorial colonial troops of about division strength. Of those forces, those five different divisions, only the 29th Division, a British division, has regular soldiers with any experience of warfare. And General Sir Ian Hamilton was a surprising choice. He had been Lord Kitchener's Chief of Staff in the South African War, and in 1915 was in charge of one of the regional commands. It is relatively easy to assume that Kitchener picked him because Hamilton never made problems. In some ways, he was a bit of a yes man. Now, Robin Pryor has made this comment about Ian Hamilton. It's a man who can reliably said knew little of the Dardanelles, the Turkish army, or modern war. Now, I have to say, I thought, oh, gee, that's a bit hard, Robin. I think you might be a bit tough on him because he's a very likeable character, but he's totally ineffectual. And I recently read his diary about the Gallipoli diaries, and this is what he admitted upon his appointment. My knowledge of the Dardanelles was nil. Of the Turk, nil. Of the strength of our own forces, next to nil. So not quite so bad, is it, Joe? next to nil is better than nil, isn't it? But never mind them. It is now recognised, but it wasn't at the time, that amphibious landings are the most complex and risky of military operations to perform. They need careful planning and many rehearsals. Just think of Operation Overlord in the Second World War. But that did not happen for the Gallipoli landings. Nor had the British Navy or Army undertaken an imposed amphibious operation since 1805, which was some time ago during the Napoleonic Wars, and never on the scale of this enterprise. And then they seem to forget about these people. The Ottoman forces are 6-week divisions, round about 84,000 men. Hamilton has just over 70,000, so he doesn't have the strength to match this number. And these are tough, hardy, experienced soldiers. They've been fighting wars for the Ottoman Empire for the last 20 years, and they have a sprinkling of German officers in senior command positions. I chose this slide because it's slightly unusual. That is actually an advertisement for a German brandy. They're toasting the Dardanelles. So yeah, toasting the Dardanelles, which is a little surprising for an Islamic nation, I think, to be advertising this. But I'll put it in anyway because it drives home the task. Now, Hamilton had nowhere near enough troops to undertake the task ahead, but he made the situation worse by dividing the strength of his own forces in 4 separate landings. And that is why the Gallipoli campaign fails. It does not recover from the fact that Hamilton has ignored a fundamental principle of command and divided his forces. And you can see it on this map. Remember, he's got 70,000 troops. The 29th Division are the best. They are doing 5 separate landings at Cape Howell. There you see them on different designated beaches. And none of these landings can mutually support each other. Then there is this diversion across on the Asiatic mainland. The French division will attack at Kumkale. And then up north, there's the Anzac division coming in between Garba Tepe and Fisherman's Hut, doing another diversion landing. And what is not shown on this map is there's another diversion air landing way the hell up here at Belair with the Royal Naval Division. He has fundamentally divided a weak force, and the campaign does not recover from this fundamental mistake. Now, it's known at the time that Australians and New Zealanders were only partially trained, were inexperienced, were of doubtful quality, but they were keen. As a result, they were given the subordinate role in the initial landings, one that it was thought would require little skill and was not expected to be difficult. The Anzacs, as they were now called, were to land to the north of Garba Tepe, while the British and French made the main effort to the south. So here's the Anzac landing between here and a place called Fisherman's Hut, just up here. And I have an image of the landing. The Australians and New Zealanders landed in 4 separate waves on the 25th of April 1915. Their objective was to seize a hill some 6,000 yards east of the landing beaches called Maltepe, and they were also to seize the Surrey Bear Heights. The first to come ashore on that fateful morning were the 1,500 Australians of the 3rd Australian Brigade, and they landed just after 5 a.m. The rest of this brigade landed just after that wave, the second wave, 4,000 troops, and they cleared the first ridges ahead of them. Another Australian brigade, the third one, the 2nd Brigade, landed later that morning. The first New Zealanders did not come ashore until 10 a.m, but they were the elements of the New Zealand headquarters. The first combat troops from New Zealand did not land until after 11 a.m, and they were part of the fourth and final wave of troops ashore that day and consisted of the New Zealanders and the fourth Australian Brigade. And then late in the afternoon, the Otago and Canterbury battalions were landed, and they were the last ones to land. But as soon as the New Zealanders landed, they were immediately rushed into action as separate companies and sometimes even as individual platoons. The heavy casualties suffered by the Australians in the afternoon and the broken nature of the terrain had made it imperative to rush as many men forward as possible. And this is what the first New Zealand historian of the campaign said, Major Fred Waite, and he was actually there. The result was that units of both divisions became hopelessly mixed up, and it was several days before they could be disentangled. The landings had been chaotic throughout the day, with troops arriving to no apparent schedule. And then there is the great mystery of the 25th of April. Between 11 a.m. and 3 p.m, so some 4 hours, no troops and no equipment was landed at all, which the New Zealand history calls a strange hitch, admitting, and I'm quote, precious hours were wasted. Adding to the confusion was the fact that the fourth wave, that is, the New Zealanders and the 4th Australian Brigade, had no specific orders. They actually didn't know what their task was. This is what some New Zealand soldiers said on this day. It was absolute chaos. No control, no order, no front lines. We weren't even meant to be among those hills and ravines and precipices. While Dan Curran would add, there was no one to give us orders at all and a lot of panic. By the late afternoon, the Anzac soldiers had penetrated to a depth of just on a mile. They hadn't taken the crucial third ridge of the Surrey Bear Mount of the Surrey Bear Range, and they had failed to get anywhere near Maltepe, still thousands of yards away. And owing to their exhaustion, their inexperience, and the opposition of the Turkish defenders, which had been organised by a commander who knew how to act very quickly, they could get no further. And here you see what they were planning to do and what they actually did. This dotted line here are the objectives, so they're trying to get to this is the Anzacs, the Surrey Bear Range, and trying to get to this big hill here called Maltepe. The actual shaded area here is what they actually achieved. It's worse even south at Cape Hellas, with the 29th Division coming ashore. It was an absolute bloodbath, particularly on V, V and X Beach. They were supposed to get up to here, take Krithia and the hill Archibaba, but you can see the thin toehold that they have. And the French get a little bit of Kankale and they withdraw the next day and reinforce Cape Hellas. This is the smallest of toeholds on the Gallipoli Peninsula, but one which thousands of Anzac soldiers would come to know so well over the coming months. Now, the Canadian professor Tim Travers wrote a very good history of the Gallipoli campaign, and he has summarised what went wrong on the 25th of April. And I'll leave you to read it because it is a litany of errors and woes. I count over 10 things that had gone wrong, from the incorrect landing place to the loss of surprise to the sudden shift to the flanks rather than going for depth, no artillery support, the quick Turkish response, and the panic of some commanders. I think Professor Travers has it summed up rather neatly in this paragraph. Travers also states that if you read his last line, everything that had gone wrong, it's a wonder that the Anzac troops really did as well as they did. So we have the forces of the Mediterranean Expeditionary Force pinned in on two narrow lodgements, the British and French at Cape Hellas and the Australians and New Zealanders at Anzac. There was going to be no swift victory here for the Allies. I think Corelli Barnett actually sums it up best in this rather evocative phrase of his. And he says, there ensued stalemate and trench warfare, perhaps even more ghastly than on the Western Front, in which the stench of corpses rotting in the blazing sun of May, June and July blended with the perfume of wild thyme and the very narrowness of the front and rear areas added a dreaded claustrophobia. But there was more muddle for the New Zealanders and Australians to come, particularly for the New Zealand Brigade and the 4th Australian Brigade, which have taken down from up north here, from Anzac Cove, brought into Cape Hellas, and are told to make an attack across this position here, the Daisy Patch, trying to take the village of Krithia and the hill behind it. Unfortunately, nobody had told the New Zealanders what they were supposed to do. And this is reflected in this officer's comment. You can see this is not a great plan, and this is the British official history. We have four weak battalions to attack in full daylight, a position held by at least nine battalions of Turks, without any orders. And this is what one of the officers said of this attack across the Daisy Patch. We knew nothing, not even how far it was to the front line. And being totally devoid of cover, as Fred Waite records, the converging machine gun fire from the clumps of fir trees swept the ground like a hose. Now, the New Zealanders were told to attack twice across this ground. They took no ground at all for the loss of over 800 casualties in the space of a single afternoon. They are there in these deadlocked positions for the next 3 months. The Turks make several attempts to drive the infidels into the sea. They were all constant failures. And conditions at Gallipoli were absolutely dreadful. The dangers and hardships included, obviously, enemy artillery and rifle fire, but there were added to that the flies, fleas and lice and the disease they spread, the difficulty evacuating wounded, the extreme climate, the poor rations, which made people extremely sick after being on them for 9 months. It became so bad at Anzac Cove that you could smell the stench of death and decay 10 miles out to sea. You knew you're approaching the Anzac Peninsula, Anzac Cove. After 3 months of deadlock, General Hamilton looked for a breakthrough elsewhere, and that was going to be in the area north of Anzac Cove, which seemed to offer a good prospect to outflank the enemy. And it involved particularly capturing the high ground of the Surrey Bear Range and getting beyond it. But unfortunately, General Alexander Godley, who's basically in charge of the Australians and New Zealanders for this part of the plan, produced a highly ambitious plan that asked too much of the troops who were put into action. To have any chance of success, it needed detailed planning, tight coordination, a skilled, decisive battle commander calling the shots, and some degree of luck. All of those essential factors were missing from the August offensive, and it becomes an absolute bloodbath for Australians and New Zealanders, despite some epic fighting, particularly by the Australians at Lone Pine and by the New Zealanders at Chanak Vaea, which is the furthest point reached inland on the Gallipoli Peninsula, but it was taken at such a cost, and little wonder that Fred Waite would describe the 8th of August 1915, and I'm quoting from him, the blackest day on the peninsula. And he writes, and I'm quoting him up here, a portion of Chanak Vaea was undoubtedly ours, but at what cost? Many of the finest men of the Dominion lay dead upon the crest. I don't have time to cover the muddle and command incompetence of the Suvla Bay landing, but I will comment upon one other degree of muddle, and this is the attack on Hill 60. This is a further tragic footnote to the August offensive, an insignificant mound known as Hill 60 on the left flank of the Anzac position. Tragically, it had not been defended prior to the August offensive, but it was once that started. And the attacks that happened in late August on Hill 60 all but consumed what remained of the rifle brigade. And at least 236 mounted riflemen died in the fighting for Hill 60, not to mention the hundreds of Australians and British soldiers who were killed. Now, one of the best accounts of the Gallipoli campaign is by Robert Rhodes James, who produced it to mark the 50th anniversary, and I don't think there's been a book to actually better it. And this is what he says about Hill 60. For connoisseurs of military futility, valour and incompetence and determination, the attacks on Hill 60 are in a class of their own. You're a connoisseur of military futility, Joe? It's a damning indictment. The failure of this last offensive marked the end of the road for the Allies. It also marked the end of the road for General Hamilton's career. To take that small ground in the August offensive Hamilton had lost over 40,000 men in this offensive to win what he described as some elbow room. He reported that back to London and asked for a further 95,000 troops so he could use them in a fresh offensive. That was too much for Kitchener. Hamilton is replaced on the 16th of October by a more realistic general who's brought in from France, General Sir Charles Monroe, who visited Gallipoli, just stayed on the beaches and made this assessment. The force, in short, held a line possessing every possible military defect. An advance from the positions we held could not be regarded as a reasonable military operation to expect. Monroe said we need to leave, and if we leave, I think we're going to suffer between 30 to 40% casualties. Now, I've got to say, Winston Churchill, in his history of the First World War, is absolutely scathing about Monroe, and he comes up with what is called probably the best line in military history, and this is what Churchill writes. He came, he saw, he capitulated, you know, which is a which is a twist on that Julius Caesar one. You know, I came, I saw, I conquered. He came, he saw, he capitulated. And Carlyle describes it as a cracking line, but this is what he said. It is a cracking line, but it is unjust because there was no other alternative. Now, unlike any other part of the campaign, the two evacuations were meticulously planned, well controlled and flawlessly executed. It's such a complex and dangerous military operation for which there was no military precedent, was executed without great loss, was a remarkable achievement. But after 8.5 months and with over 140,000 casualties and nothing to show for it, the Gallipoli campaign was finally over. What of New Zealand's losses? I've always used the figures from this book, Richard Stowers, who I think is one of the unsung fine historians of the Gallipoli campaign. And Richard Stowers wrote a book in 2005 with meticulous research, and he was one of the first people to question how many New Zealanders had served on Gallipoli. The official accepted figure was 8,556, because that's what General Hamilton had said, and Chris Pugsley, the expert on Gallipoli, said that, well, that must be true. Stowers said, no, it can't be then. There's about at least 14,000 New Zealanders serving on Gallipoli, and he says that some 57% of the force became casualties. Some 2,779 killed, and another 20% of those who served. I have to say that we've moved on from this. He pioneered this change in figures, but we're getting much closer from this book, which I have to say is available as a free book, and it's moved well away from Pugsley and Hamilton's 8,556 figure to somewhere between 16 and 17,000, not quite sure exactly that number, and a casualty rate of 52%, which is exactly the same as the Australians. But all those who served on Gallipoli were in some way affected by it, whether they were wounded, whether they had sickness and disease, and they suffered from their service for the rest of their lives. I'm now going to move and talk about myths of Gallipoli. Now, I'm aware that that word has several meanings. I use the word as a historian to mean commonly accepted facts, ideas, or significance that really has no historical foundation. I'm going to use the second definition in the Oxford Dictionary, which basically sums it up as a widely held but false idea or belief or idea. It gives you an example, and then it comes up with a few synonyms: a misconception, a fallacy, a mistaken belief, or a false notion. And the Gallipoli campaign is replete with them, and I'm only going to look at three in this presentation. And I start with probably the most powerful and prevalent myth, and it is this: that the Anzacs were landed in the wrong place. There has been a persistent myth that the Anzacs on the 25th of April were landed in an incorrect position. This is because Anzac Cove was one of the worst places on the peninsula to make an opposed landing. On all three sides were sheer jagged cliffs which dominated the area and overlooked the beach. Who in their right mind would want to land here? And two Australian historians have summed the area up as being, quote, topographically challenging. The terrain was as difficult as it is possible to transgress, and in some ways it's one of the worst locations to carry out an amphibious landing. But it has been claimed by many historians that this is what went wrong, and I have to say I'm guilty of this as well. Instead of landing at the obvious place, which is a gentle beach further a mile to the south, they landed at Anzac Cove, and that landing has been blamed on the Navy. Of course, the Army always blames the Navy. Poor navigation, a strong current, or just things going wrong, the friction of war. I have to say that recent Australian historians have really demolished this myth, and I'm only going to give you a summation of Peter Stanley in his book, Queen's Post. And Peter Stanley writes that it's been an article of faith that the landings were made in the wrong place. But recent research by Dennis Winter, British historian, Tim Travers, Canadian historian, Tom Frame, Australian naval officer turned historian, has shown that it conclusively refutes the idea. And Tom Frame, who, as I say, was a navigator in the Australian Navy, demonstrates that it would have been possible for naval navigators to have made a more precise landfall. The idea that currents, poor navigation, carried the force of modern oil should be disregarded. That myth has been thoroughly discredited in Robin Pryor's recent book, and Pryor demonstrates conclusively that the problem was the exact landing place was never designated. It was a 3-mile space between Aribanu and Fisherman's Hut, Gabatep and Fisherman's Hut, and the exact landing spot was never designated. And in some ways, they were actually fortunate to land where they were, because there were very few Ottoman defenders here. It meant that the area was lightly defended. Two platoons of Ottoman infantry faced the Australians when they landed, and one of the platoons ran away. So they're really only facing a platoon, less than 100 people. One runs away, so they're facing about 50 people. And those platoons had rifles only, no machine guns or artillery. It was not Ottoman opposition that morning that prevented the Anzacs reaching their objectives. It was faulty leadership, particularly the brigade commander pushing his troops to the flanks because he's worried about being attacked on the flanks. So they actually went wide rather than deep, which was what their orders were. So that myth should be put to rest, that they landed in the wrong place. The second myth is this, the significance of capturing Chunuk by air. There's this other persistent myth that capturing and retaining Chunuk by air would have somehow been the turning point of the campaign and possibly the whole war. Chunuk by air, many argued and believed, held the key to victory or defeat. And General Hamilton actually reflected this in his diary, because this is what he wrote. With Chunuk by air, we win. Okay, remember, he is always an optimist. Chunuk by air will do, with that we win. Even the Australian official historian Charles Bean went even further than this, stating that the capture of Chunuk by air would have knocked Turkey and possibly Bulgaria out of the war. But the most extreme version of this myth appears in a book by the writer, the late Maurice Shadbolt, who stated that the capture of Chunuk by air might have altered the course of world history. And this is what he writes in his book, The Voices of Gallipoli. And you can read that. He's basically saying, if we had held on to it, we would have changed the course of world history. There would have been no Treaty of Versailles, no Adolf Hitler, no Bolshevik Russia. And he says that the taking of Chunuk by air, it is possible to argue, might well have given the 20th century a chance to be otherwise. At least it can be said that New Zealand has never been nearer to deciding the destiny of great nations. All of this, I have to say, is very unlikely, and it defies the topographic reality of Gallipoli. Hamilton and others seem to forget that on the first day of the campaign, the objective had been to seize Maltepe, which they considered the key to advance on the Narrows. Chunuk by air was going to be regarded as insignificant to be bypassed on the way. Even if Chunuk by air had been held, the Gallipoli campaign would have had to continue. It does not mean that the Narrows would fall into their hands like a ripe plum. Just because you can see something from a prominent feature does not make it any easier to get there, and the Narrows were still some distance away. Added to this is that nobody had given any thought to how they could sustain an advance from Surrey by the Surrey Meteor Range. That is logistical difficulties. That's something that commanders seem to ignore. Landing enough supplies on Gallipoli, including food, water, animal fodder, ammunition, had been backbreaking and laborious. Moving those supplies any great distance presented insurmountable difficulties. Now, these unpleasant military realities were recognised by a British officer, Major W. Harrison, who later returned to Gallipoli and did something that none of the British commanders ever did in 1915. He actually walked over the battleground. And the area that we're talking about is between here, the Surrey Meteor Range, and to the Narrows. And this is what he wrote in a journal article. Between the Surrey Meteor Mountain and the Straits is a tumbled mass of hills, little less in height than the mountain itself. This stretch of country is almost indescribably difficult for military operations. It consists of a tangled mass of deep ravines with precipitous sides and choked with scrub. Had we taken Surrey by air, we would still have to have been faced with an advance of some 6 miles across this type of country before we could have secured positions dominating the straits. And this is key. The Surrey by air mountain was in no way a key to the peninsula. That is the reality rather than the myth. Chanak by air is certainly an important feature on the Surrey by air range, not even the highest feature on the Surrey by air range. It's still overlooked by two other hills. But it is just a hill with plenty more hills and obstacles between it and the 6 miles to the Narrows. It is in no way a key to the Gallipoli Peninsula or to anything else. And the third myth that I will look at is the myth that Gallipoli could have ended the war. This myth states that Gallipoli was a brilliant strategic scheme that promised huge rewards. But for its faulty execution, success on Gallipoli would have knocked Turkey out of the war and could have ended it early. Now, Robin Pryor makes this the focus of his publication on Gallipoli, and he makes the point that even if the fleet had reached Constantinople, which was in no way a certainty because they still hadn't figured out how to deal with mines and those shore batteries that were defending them, that the Ottoman Turks would not have surrendered, but they would have fought on to the end. And he concludes his book, Gallipoli, The End of the Myth, with this paragraph. All of this leads to the unwelcome conclusion about Gallipoli and the Dardanelles. Despite the bravery of the Allied troops who fought there, and that's never in question, the campaign was fought in vain. It did not shorten the war by a single day, nor did it in reality ever offer that prospect. As Churchill said, then promptly forgot, Germany is the foe, and it is bad war to seek cheaper victories. And you get the picture, basically saying this was not a good idea and it was never going to lead to the end of the war. This does not imply, however, that there are no meanings around Gallipoli, that it lacks meaning for Australia and New Zealand. But one of the problems with tracing what this campaign means is that it does change. The current meanings I'm going to look at, is the thorny issue of national identity. Now, Professor Hugh Strawn, who was the Cicelli Professor of History at Oxford University and has been here several times, is a world authority on the First World War, and he wrote that the national identity of three nations, Australia, New Zealand and Turkey, is woven around the Gallipoli experience. And certainly the Australian Prime Minister, Billy Hughes, believed that it was the Gallipoli moment that Australia became a nation, and emerged from the shambles at Gallipoli. And this is how he addressed Australian soldiers whenever he saw them. And he basically says, the day you landed at Anzac, the Australian nation was born. Before that, we were New South Welshmen, Queenslanders, Victorians. And on that day, we became Australians. New Zealanders who served believed that it was on Gallipoli that they started to discover themselves as New Zealanders. Ormond Burton, who was a decorated war hero and became a Methodist minister and later a jailed for pacifism in the Second World War, is much quoted, and he makes a similar comment. Before the war, it might be said that men in New Zealand were unaware of the fundamental unities which bound them. And he points out that it is here that they started to realise themselves as New Zealanders, a process that was not complete, but it was well begun. Another New Zealand soldier, Henry Lewis, 70 years later, said this: "One thing we learned quick, we weren't English, nor were we like them." There were several other soldiers have made that comment as well. Aubrey Herbert, who was a fine writer, Irish Guards officer, author, member of parliament, spoke 10 languages, veteran of 3 disasters, wrote a fantastic book about the First World War, and even he noticed that the New Zealanders were different. And this is the story about the Wellington Battalion immediately after Chanuk Bayir. And he says, "I abide nothing more in the war than the spirit of those 63 New Zealanders." He points out that New Zealanders really received recognition like the Australians. They were different, and he points out that the distance from their shores made them coalesce, and he points out that they had a silent pride which put things into proper perspective. The spirit of these men was unconquered and unconquerable. Now, it's doubtful that any one event can create an elusive and changing identity as a country's national identity. Where it begins and ends is it impossible to say. And one historian, Ron Polanski, has done quite a bit of research on this and believes that there's evidence to show that New Zealanders first saw themselves as distinct people well before 1900. And what I would say is that in New Zealand's national identity, in Australia's national identity, and even in Turkey's national identity, it is impossible to ignore what happened at Gallipoli all those years ago. Second man is we became different to how we saw the Australians. In Egypt, we had not wanted to be associated with the Australians. We thought they were loud, brash, and wanted to fight all the time. When we got into trouble, we blamed the Australians. When they got into trouble, they blamed us. That changed at Gallipoli. As Fred Waite wrote, "At Anzac, we found our brothers in arms, the gallant sons of Australia, and we did our work together." And this is a point Chris Pugsley makes, and I've got to say, all the research I've done, I thoroughly agree with this. Every letter, every diary records the praise and admiration for the Australian effort. Difficult, I know, but it's true. He points out that their rivalry would exist, but there's this mutual admiration under it. This is also an important thing that happened at Gallipoli. This is another important change that happened to all nations. The British poet laureate Philip Larkin, often described as the poet for the common man and rated by the Times newspaper as Britain's greatest post-war poet, wrote a very moving poem called 1914. And this is its poignant last verse: "Never such innocence, never before or since." I'll move on a little bit. "Without a word, the men leaving the gardens tidy, the thousands of marriages lasting a little while longer, never such innocence again." Clearly, Larkin has identified a significant change and tied it to 1914. But that significant change for Britain, for New Zealand and Australia, happened in 1915, which is seen as a critical year. And this is the theme of Lynn MacDonald's book 1915, which has as its subtitle The Death of Innocence. And she writes that it was a year of cobbling together, of frustration, of indecision, in a sense a year of innocence, and therein lies the tragedy. And the tragedy is this: the New Zealanders and Australians had learned a painful and costly lesson. Courage, resourcefulness and some natural ability were not going to be enough in this war. They couldn't compensate for failures in planning, leadership, logistics and administration, and no soldiers in this war could afford to be committed to battle only partially trained. This was a steep and costly learning curve, and it does mark the death of innocence for, I think, New Zealand at the time. Then there is this notion I call a sense of place. I'll put the next slide up. So important has this campaign become to each nation's heritage that New Zealanders and Australians have developed a sense of place about Gallipoli without having been there. mention Gallipoli, and in their mind's eye they can see or visualise a small narrow cove, a short crowded section of beach, the steep tangled sheer razorback ridges that reach almost to the shoreline, and that is often reflected in the book covers. And I have to say, so strong was the sense of place that the New Zealand Postal Service, when it looked for a commemorative stamp to mark the 50th anniversary of Gallipoli, did not even bother with soldiers or other symbols or monuments. They just put Anzac Cove, and it's instantly recognisable to people who know anything about their military history. I don't think there is another battle that's quite like this, except perhaps for the Australians, the Kokoda Track, which also resonates as a sense of place. And you can see this also in this famous stained glass window at St Andrew's Church. Let me wrap up and with some concluding thoughts on Gallipoli. Invested with such meaning, this campaign has been transformed. The stark reality is that Gallipoli was a serious defeat for the Allies. The costly failure had no significance on the war whatsoever, apart from encouraging the Turks to fight on and later bringing Bulgaria into the war as well. It was a military endeavour that was marked with muddle and command incompetence from its very beginning, and where the most successful part of the campaign was its ending. But keep in mind that warning from Les Carlyon, that Gallipoli is a country of the mind, and everybody sees the story the way they want to see it. And for most of us, the campaign has become much more than just a severe military defeat for Australia and New Zealand. It has become linked to the foundations of nationhood. It was a time when the nations learned much about itself and about each other. It was the time when both countries started to grow up. And Gallipoli has become something bigger and better than just its military reality. And it has been transformed into a type of victory. Ultimately, Gallipoli is a victory of the human spirit over death, suffering and the futility of war. This was alluded to in Maurice Shadbolt's eloquent conclusion to Voices of Gallipoli, and I think he did get this right. He makes this point, no men tried harder or reached higher. In death they command the peninsula as they never did in life. Chanuk Bayir may not be holy ground, but is certainly a place of pilgrimage for New Zealanders. Listen long enough as the Aegean wind whispers up the gullies and sings among the Turkish pines, and the dead of Gallipoli live a little again. They may well live a little forever. So Gallipoli has become a victory over death, a victory over military incompetence and muddle. It is a victory of the ordinary soldier struggling against things he cannot control or understand, but which will probably cause him death or injury. This peculiar victory means that New Zealanders and Australians will continue to experience Gallipoli as a vivid and powerful sense of place, if only in their imaginations, the only battle of the First World War where this has happened. This victory is an imagined one, but sometimes they can be more powerful and enduring than the real thing. And I'm going to leave the last word to the ever-perceptive Les Carlyon in his book on Gallipoli, and he says this, Gallipoli, the war that got away from its handlers is a tale of all that is fine and all that is foolish in the human condition. If it made more sense, it would be a lesser story. The tale is mostly about frailty. This, along with the beauty of its setting, helps explain why it lingers in the imagination after larger and more important wars are forgotten. Tragedies have more layers than epics, and Gallipoli has somehow become bigger than the sum of its facts, which I think is immensely true. And I'll leave you with this last image here. This is a painting called Ataturk's Legacy by Margaret Hadfield, which won the inaugural Gallipoli Art Prize in 2006. And you'll notice that rather than draw soldiers and so forth, you've drawn the Gallipoli Peninsula, the sense of place. Now, there's supposed to be something quite different about this painting. You stare at it for a while and then look away and stare at it again, you're supposed to see ghostly soldiers emerge from the soil, similar to the Menengate at midnight. And somewhere you're supposed also to see Ataturk's face looking down on the Gallipoli Cove. Let me know if you do. I'll struggle to see them sometimes. Sometimes I see them, sometimes I don't. But that's it from me. Thank you.
bottom middle of the picture, another one for
Joe, you're supposed to let them find them yourself.
Sorry, and I've only been on orange juice tonight. Yeah. Well, Fred White was an engineer. Time for questions.
Yes. Militarily, did we learn anything quickly from that campaign?
I think we learned, but I don't think we learned quick enough. And most of the learning for the First World War actually occurred on the Western Front, particularly how to use artillery and combine it in a combined arms effect with infantry. The painful lessons from Gallipoli, I think, took an awful long time to sink in. And the people that studied it most, believe it or not, after the First World War were the Americans, particularly the Marine Corps, who tend to specialise in amphibious operations. And one would like to think that the legacy here might have been perhaps seen in the Second World War, particularly at Operation Overlord, where they actually spent 18 months planning it. Having said that, things still went wrong at Operation Overlord as well. So they did learn ever so slowly, but learn more on the Western Front.
And then you went on with Greece and Crete in the Second World War, but we won't get into
that. What do you make of Bud Shelford's idea that we should have a separate day for Remembrance Day for the British?
Yeah, I'll be honest, I'm not sure whether I should come. I'm not sure it's necessary. I think we have Anzac Day, and we also have a day called Remembrance Day, November the 11th, which doesn't get a lot of really attention. I think if we build up perhaps Remembrance Day a little more, that would suffice. I'm not sure the general public want a separate day as well, but they are my views. What do you think, Joe?
No, I won't voice my opinion.
Go on.
Heading back to the theme of our presentation tonight, other questions? Sorry, you can have a chat later.
Yes.
Oh, sorry. Just the Turkish perspective on, you've alluded to a lot of Western perspective on the failures, but can you offer any insight on what the Turkish perspective was on how they saw our campaign?
And I've got to say there are a lot of really good Turkish sources now available in English. First off, one of the things that Tim Travis identified was their lack of surprise. They knew there was an attack coming. The naval operations in February and then on the 18th of March indicated, well, they're not going to get through, so they're going to try a land campaign. The person in charge of the whole Gallipoli Peninsula was actually a German commander called Lehman von Sanders. He thought they were going to come up Bulia because that's where the peninsula is the narrowest, it's flat, and he had most of his defences in the north, thinking that's where they were coming. And for a couple of hours, the Royal Naval Division diversion had him thinking that they were coming at Bulia. The local Turkish commanders, particularly Kemal Atatürk, and this is the big difference on the day, reacted very quickly, putting the military forces where it was needed. The Anzac commanders, and particularly the commander of the 1st Brigade ashore and commander of 3rd Brigade, Sinclair McLagan, basically saw everything that could possibly go wrong and tried to counter it. He didn't want to push on to the 3rd Ridge because he thought they could be attacked on the 2nd Ridge, so he stopped people on the 2nd Ridge and sent them wide on the flanks to that was not his orders. His orders were to try to get to Maltep and take the Surrey Bear Range. So if you look at the difference in what happens on the 20th of April, for example, the Turkish commanders respond quickly and accurately, particularly Kemal Atatürk, and Mustafa Kemal, as he was then, and they respond far more quickly and with more and are far more effective than certainly the Australian New Zealanders and the British at Cape House. I have to say, though, that their command systems start to deteriorate, particularly in May, where they are determined to throw these infidels back into the sea, and they launch several large-scale full frontal attacks, and they get absolutely decimated. In one of the attacks on May, they lose nearly 10,000 soldiers in a single attack, which is what leads to that truce, the May truce, because there's so many dead around, and the smell's getting terrible, the risk of disease and so on. So initially, they're fighting really, really well, very astute, stopping this offensive, but they also have demonstrate considerable muddle themselves, particularly in those full frontal assaults that they do in May.
Some of you may recall a colleague of ours, Masut Uya, who was a Turkish officer lecturing at the Australian Defence Force Academy in Canberra, who gave a presentation, it was about 4 or 5 years ago, on the Turkish approach to what happened on the 25th of April. Mm. and that was quite revealing, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. Yeah. His basic view was we've got to stop seeing them as hordes, you know, we've got them two hordes, and actually see them as being quite skilled at defending their
land. Absolutely.
So out of the campaign, there was no particular medal issued after the war for that.
No.
But there was one designed and ready to go. Why was it not progressed?
To be honest, I don't know. I just know there wasn't, and they'd actually planned one. Seems to be a little remiss of not doing that. There was a earlier medal struck the 1914 Star. I'm not sure why they didn't strike a Gallipoli medal.
Because it was a disaster.
Yeah, we've struck medals for disasters before.
Yeah, that's true. Awesome. Any other questions?
You've spoken of 3 months.
Yeah.
And obviously you can't go into detail about all the other myths, but what were some of those general
I'll be honest, I don't know where to start. I should have. One of those slides I showed you sees the Anzacs coming ashore in the morning. You know, and if you look at it, this is the stained glass window at St Andrews. There's all these artillery rounds bursting in the background. There's supposedly machine guns firing them as well. Turks didn't have that on the morning. And Ian Robertson, who's ex-brigadier, has actually gone into it as to what they actually had. They only had rifles, and you know, there weren't a lot of them defending there. So that's another myth. Hopefully I'll pick the three most important ones. The big one is that, you know, could this have succeeded? Could it have changed the war? And the answer to that is no. And the reason for that is that I'll get back to another myth. Why they're doing this is there's this prevalent myth that if they knock Germany's allies out of the way, they're knocking Germany's props away, their support, and Germany will collapse. The Ottoman Turks, the Bulgarians and so forth, who they focus on, aren't propping up Germany. Germany doesn't need them. And even if you knock Turkey out of the war, there's still going to be a long war with Germany. Remember, you need to keep in mind, Germany did win the war on the Eastern Front, and they almost won the war on the Western Front in March as well. To focus on knocking the props away from Germany was a fallacy and a myth. Germany didn't really need these allies. And of course, Austria-Hungary is the other one. And so one German officer said, fighting Austria-Hungary is like being chained to a corpse because they don't actually do a lot. These are not propping Germany up. Germany's doing quite well. That's the main enemy, and that's the main enemy that needs to be defeated. Sorry, I couldn't talk about other myths as well. But.
Any other questions? Well, look, once again, it was really a good presentation on an alternative point of view, and it's something that we don't think about much, I don't think. For those that have been to Gallipoli and have walked the ground, both from an Allied point of view and a Turkish point of view, you can see the reasoning behind, you know, all the muddle, the myth and the meaning. And I guess to some, me personally, it was a pilgrimage, but I think it's important to read the books, to visit the site, and make up your own view on, you know, just how you felt about Gallipoli and where it stood in establishing a nation. Would you please all join me with thanking Glenn once again?